Actually, I want to go back briefly to an expression that we had. Actually, we were talking about Bremsstrahlen. Okay. So one rule of thumb that's useful to keep in mind, this is just sort of extracted. It doesn't follow the linear progression of our thinking. But when you have a particle and it passes through a magnetic field and it's bent and you get some emission of photons, okay, there's some sort of characteristic angle. Well, we'll call it theta. So there's some angle that light is emitted at. But if you were to look at many, many particles with the same energy and the same field and everything, then you could talk about a characteristic angle for those photons. And it basically goes as the mass of the particle, usually it's an electron, divided by the energy of that particle. Okay? So now remember, the rest mass of the particle here is a half of an MeV. And depending on what kind of an experiment you're doing, this may be in GeV. So this is a very small number, so the angle is a very small angle. But this is a nice point to make, and it doesn't depend on the energy of the photon. So the energy of the photon is just, there is some typical energy of the photon. And this angle goes down as the particle energy goes up. Okay? So that's just a quick point to make that I had skipped over before. Now, let me go back to what we did. Maybe I can reach. We had written down the differential cross-section for the Bremsstrahlen radiation as d sigma dky equals, and then I'll write out all the expression. So this piece here goes up into the logarithm. So we had written down this expression for the differential cross-section for the photons. And we're going to need that because what we actually want to do is we want to write down an expression for the energy loss that's happening due to Bremsstrahlen. Okay? And just the people that just came in, I mentioned it. I'm really not feeling very well, so I will go through the notes up through scintillation, and then we'll stop. We might stop a little bit early. All right. Hopefully I can drop this expression and move on. Now, the reason that we need that differential cross-section is kind of similar to the reason that we needed such a thing when we were trying to measure the energy loss due to ionization, which is that we have to do an integral, a weighted integral, that's weighted over the cross-section to have various momentum transfers or, various Bremsstrahlen events where you'd have different photon energies, okay? So we can write this down. So you have an electron passing through some material, say, and you have dEdx, and we'll put a symbol on here, radiative dEdx, okay, as opposed to the collisional losses that we talked about before. And we integrate this over the photon energy, there's a normalization to the number of atoms, and then we have this differential cross-section integrating over dk gamma. Okay? So let's keep these two expressions separate. So we have this integral, and this is the expression that we want to get. Now, we want to get this expression because we want to be able to ultimately understand what does the energy loss due to Bremsstrahlung look like as a function of various properties, and we're going to want to compare it to things like ionization, etc. Okay? Okay, now we know this differential cross-section piece, and if we write, we can actually move. How did I do this? Well, I can rewrite this in the following manner. This is Na E sub I, and then I'll put some brackets around here times 1 over E sub I times the integral. Okay, and I have to get rid of my Na here. All right? So I've multiplied by 1, and I've moved out the Na. Now, this piece right here, I'm not going to do, but this piece right here is sometimes called the radiative cross-section, and this equals 4 times alpha times capital Z squared Re squared, and then it has a logarithmic term which numerically simplifies to 183 divided by Z to the 1/3. And there's actually another term, a little tiny correction of 1 over 18. Okay? This is actually, that piece is written in Ferno. Unfortunately, Ferno doesn't follow through and give you the d dx. He doesn't give you the final calculation. So, whereas Gruppen and Schwarz gives you the final calculation, doesn't tell you how you got it, and leaves out this piece. So, okay, I've tried to complete the puzzle for you. That is the, you have this expression now, and what that ultimately leaves you with is, dE dx radiative equals 4 alpha Na this is little z. Remember, little z is referring to the charge of the incident particle, and capital Z is the substance that's the medium. Then you have this 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught E squared over mc squared times E. Well, we can call it E sub I, but it's E times log 183 over Z to the 1/3 plus 1 over 18. Okay? Now, so that's, if I was tall enough, I would draw a big box around it, but I'm too short, so just imagine that I drew a nice pretty box around that. So that's an important expression. One of the important aspects of this is that it is proportional to EI, okay? So it's proportional to the energy of the incident particle, and it's increasing with that energy, okay? Okay, so that actually, this is an important point, because if you'll remember, dE dx collisional, the one that we had done before, was proportional to the log of the energy. Okay? So one of these is going up linearly with energy, and the other one is going up logarithmically with energy. Depending on how these normalization, all these other constants that are in here, balance out, at some point, this guy is going to pass up this guy as the dominant energy loss mechanism. And that is very important for detector design and understanding your detectors and et cetera. Okay? So I'll talk... There's an energy where that happens called the critical energy, and I will talk about that some. So radiative energy loss really does dominate at sufficiently high energy. There's another aspect about this, which is that this goes as z squared, where the collisional losses, if you were to look back, go as z. This is capital Z, the z of the medium that you're interacting with. Okay? So again, the way to say this is that the charge of the medium dictates when this transition to radiative energy loss dominating will happen. Okay, that's a kind of a convoluted sentence, but hopefully it makes sense. If I have a very large Z atom, then radiative energy losses will dominate at a lower energy. They will dominate more quickly. If I have a low Z atom, hydrogen, for instance, it will happen much later, okay? Because this is part of the balance between these two things. If you're going to compare them, you also have to compare them for the same substance. Okay, so heavier elements cause the radiation to dominate sooner. All right. We can simplify this a little. In most cases, this 1 over 18 doesn't matter. I just put it there so you know it's there, and most books will put it. But we can simplify this a little bit in the case where usually what we're dealing with is an electron. Okay, we're usually, in most experiments, except maybe air shower array experiments or other things, we're dealing with electrons, okay? And so z, little z, is 1. So one can simplify this just a touch. And this is an expression that's a good idea. Now this here is Re squared, so I'll just make that substitution. So this is one of these expressions that it's kind of like the beta block expression. You really want to have whether you remember it perfectly or not, you want to have that handy. That's a useful expression. Okay?
Oh,
Re is the electron radius.
Okay.
It's pretty small, yeah. Yeah. So, you can calculate it. It's pretty small. Okay? All right. Okay. Okay. Having done this, we can actually now go to something that we already talked about, but I actually could only just sort of mention it without explaining why, where it comes from. So you keep this expression, and we can think about this a little differently. We can try to understand something about what is happening to the energy. So we can take all of this. Let me see if I can do this neatly. All of this is really just a constant that is either a constant like alpha or Re2, or it has to do with the material Z, A, and A. Okay, Z. So this is all essentially can be attributed to a property of the material. All right. So we're going to call all of this one over chi naught. Okay? This variable is the radiation length. Well, you already seen it once on Tuesday. So this is the radiation length. And we can write this, I hope I did it right, as dE dx equals E over psi naught. I can rearrange this because I'm going to want to do an integration. I want to see what E is it functionally. So I can end up with dE over E equals dx over chi naught. Okay? So if I go ahead and do the algebra, or I guess there's a little calculus here, so what I end up with is that E, I got a negative sign. I got a negative sign error somewhere. Okay. All right. Anyways, I'm not sure where I didn't write it down. I think maybe it comes in here. So this is saying that the energy of the particle is going to be decreasing as you pass through the material. Okay, and what is chi naught? Well, chi naught is the distance traveled where E goes to 1 over E of its initial value. I'll call that E0, E naught. Okay? So for, so it's just going to be E to the minus 1. All right? So it's like you would do with things like lifetimes and things, and it's a characteristic of the material. So, you know, different materials have different radiation lengths, and you have to know them. And they can be fairly calculable. At the end of the day, they also need to be looked at or measured. So let me, I think I have a table here. Yeah, so, hello. It was showing before. Okay. So, some of these substances you'll see as we go forward. There are a lot of scintillators and things. But air, for instance, you can deal with radiation lengths in terms of gram per cm squared. We talked about this before, or centimeters. Obviously, you need a lot of centimeters of air to add up to any appreciable amount of matter. But if you talk about it in terms of grams per centimeter squared, it actually compares relatively well to many of these others. So you can see how they vary in terms of distance. And then in terms of sort of this density. Lead is really nice because if you're trying to build a detector to absorb energy compactly, you don't want this thing to take up a lot of volume, well, then you just put some lead in front of the particle and it will lose energy pretty fast. If you don't care about that, and you have other reasons to do it, you might pick something like bismuth germanate or sodium iodide, which have a higher radiation length. But actually, these, we're going to talk about scintillators. These are substances that are used because they can give you very good energy resolution. You can actually see something that tells you what the energy is, where lead is pretty much opaque to everything, so you can't. So there's pros and cons, but in any case, this table, I think, I can't remember if this one is from Fernow or Leo, but every book has some table of some of these standard things. These are scintillators here. A lot of these other ones are what we would call absorbers. When we talk about calorimeters, that's really what you're going to use them for. You're going to put a bunch of lead in front of a particle. It's going to produce a lot of ionization, and you're going to measure that. Okay. And hopefully you get a sense for the range of these things. These are both radiation lengths, but in different units. Okay, so if you know the density of air, I mean, you can work out the relationship between these two. Okay. So when you have a column of air, okay, so you have some number of grams per centimeter squared, okay, and then of course you have the distance, the that you have to travel through that to, what do I want to say? To lose 1 over E energy. That's because, yes, because if you were to go through this calculation, okay, the number of atoms in air is very small, okay? So if you went through this calculation, you would get a very long distance, okay? All right? But, again, you can essentially, you don't really, it depends on how you want to do the problem. You do not want to build a calorimeter out of air, okay, because it will be gigantic. Actually, I take that back. That's not true. Cosmic air shower experiments do use air as their calorimeter because there's a ton of it. And that's the only way that they could see extremely high energy particle showers. But there, the showers aren't as long as this table. They're gigantic. They're up in the atmosphere. They may be a kilometer long. So in terms of length, but in terms of the number of atoms that is causing the radiation, air is not that dissimilar to plastic or water. It's just there are fewer of them. The density is lower. I don't know if that... Okay? So I jumped around last lecture giving them in both numbers. For most accelerator physics purposes, you're dealing with solids, and it's convenient to think in terms of lengths, which is kind of natural. But if you're building something else, I mean, if you've got a giant water detector or an air shower detector, then you're dealing with huge ranges of numbers, and you may want to do the other. So the books go back and forth between both. Okay? So that's radiation length. And that is really a very important... that is really a very important property of different materials. And another case where it matters is, so let's imagine you're going to want to build a detector that can measure particles, measure a charged particles and electrons' energy really well. And we haven't gotten to this, but that might be a calorimeter. But you also need to measure the sign of its charge, so you need to put it in a tracker with a magnetic field and see if it bends one way versus the other. One way would be a positive charge, the other way would be the negative. Okay, well, now you've got to build in front of your calorimeter that's going to measure the energy, you've got to build a tracker. But you have to hold that tracker up. That tracker itself is made of material. And you want to have that material amount to as little number of radiation lengths as possible, because you don't want your electron in the tracker. It's already going to brim because there's a magnetic field and things like that, but you don't want it to start brimming and interacting with the material of the detector as much as possible. I mean, you can't be perfect. You can't build a tracker that has zero number of radiation lengths, but you want to minimize it. And so this is a way that you measure that, and then you try to total out, well, what did I build it out of? How much of it is a typical particle going through? And you have to go through that estimation. Okay? Let's see what the next... I'm not there yet. Okay, so there's one other aspect to this. Kind of correction on that formula, which is that really, for the most part, we've ignored, we've considered bremsstrahlung to be happening because the particle is passing through the material, and what's happening is it's subject to a very intense electric field from the atomic nucleus. But that really... that's not the only interaction that's happening. There are, in each of the atoms, so we, again, here's my standard drawing of an atom. We have a particle, it may be passing by the nucleus, it may not be. It may be passing by one of, very classical description, not really right, but it may actually be passing by one of the electrons in the atom, okay? And if it gets close enough, it too can produce bremsstrahlung. I mean, you can have the same interaction. However, what it does is it takes this expression and it just adds another term. So this really, we have this capital Z squared, all right? This would have to be corrected so that it was really... Z squared plus Z, okay? Or it might be written as Z times Z plus 1, okay? So this piece right here, you have to replace with this expression here. So that's if you're trying, and if you put it in, there are cases where this term, when Z is not so large, where Z is not negligible compared to Z squared. So when we talked before, we have our incident particle, and our discussion really was about the case where that particle was interacting with the nucleus. So there's an electric field there, and it causes the particle's path to bend, and there's a Bremsstrahlung photon that gets emitted. That process goes as Z squared of this nucleus. This nucleus has many charges in it, and that's what's happening. In the case of this particle passing by the atomic electrons, it's really only interacting with one electron at a time, okay? And without really deriving it, I'm just saying that what you need to do is there is a second term that you have to include in this dEdx to account for the interactions with the atomic electrons. So this expression is an approximation that's only true. It would be true to, I mean, if you thought about, for instance, I don't remember the Z of lead, but it's something like 80, 82. You know, well, Z squared is going to be vastly larger than Z. Okay? It'll basically be almost 100 times larger than Z. So this term is almost negligible. But if you're dealing something much lighter, like, you know, oxygen, you know, water, for instance, well, your typical Z is much lower, and so this term is a significant fraction of the total radiation losses that you would see. Okay? So you have to account for that in that case. Yeah, I didn't derive it, but essentially the point you're making is why there's a Z here and there's a 1 here. Okay?
Why we are increasing the energy
loss? Because you have to get close to the particle to have enough of a field to produce the Bremsstrahlung. Okay? So either you're going to go and you're going to interact with the nucleus, which is what we already covered, or if you're further out, you may not get enough of an interaction for a nucleus to matter, but you may have an interaction with one of the atomic electrons. Okay. Now, it will only be one of the electrons. It won't be all of them, so there will be just one case. But that can happen. I mean, they're just two sets of charge. There's this charge. I mean, I'm doing a classical picture here, which isn't really right, but, you know, you have the nuclear charge here, and here's the atomic charge. So if I come close to this, I have this term. If I come close to this, I have this term. Okay? I know the charge is 1 for the electron. That's why there's a 1. I know the charge of this is Z, that's why I have this term.
So for this Z squared plus Z term, are we including the energy loss due to this electron and this together?
That if you make this replacement, now, so if I change this to this, now that whole expression accounts for energy losses, radiative energy losses by interactions with the nucleus and by interactions with the atomic electrons. Okay, does that help? Okay. Okay, so, all right, that's what I wanted to say about that. Now, the next thing I wanted to talk about was the critical energy. Okay. Okay, as we said before, the collisional losses go up as the log of energy. The radiative losses go up as energy itself. Okay? So what you want to do is find out, at some point they're going to cross. Where is that point? Okay? And so you can make an equation between the collisional losses, which were the ionization ones that we talked about, and the, and this is, let me write it explicitly. This is a function of E sub I. Okay. Now, we have the radiative dE dx here, and you have also, when we talked about ionization, we talked about for electrons what the ionization term looked like, and So what you can do, and it obviously it depends on the particle, but you can set an equation between these two. And when they're equal, at that point, above that energy, you will have more radiative losses than you have from ionization. So there's a lot of constants here, but the result of this is that we can talk about a critical energy, which is something like 610 MeV divided by Z plus 1.24, okay? And this is really just, you want to take these two equal to each other and figure out what the energy equals, and then you have a bunch of constants, okay? It's just algebra. There's no point in me going through it. But and each textbook has a somewhat different expression. One has 800 MeV here and 1.14 here. They just did it a slightly different approximations and things like that. But in general, it's 6 to 7 to 800 MeV here, and it's 1 point something here. And this approximation works, pretty well. I didn't do an example, but we could think about, for instance, what this would be for an electron that was traveling through, say, iron. And so there you have something like 610 MeV. And the Z of iron, do I have this? Yeah, the Z is 56, if I recall, plus 1.24. So this is going to be around 11 MeV. Okay? So at approximately 11, 10 to 15 MeV, you will see a crossover point. So this kind of thing is shown here. So probably show me wrong. I don't remember which substance we had. But no, actually, it's pretty close. So here you have the energy of a particle in MeV. This is now for electrons. You remember the electrons. And this goes now to a very, very low energy. So there actually turns out there is a little bit of a increase in dEdx, but that didn't show up in the data plot that I showed you last time. But for the most part, it's very, very flat. Has this relativistic rise. But then this is the Bremsstrahlung loss, which is almost linear. And they cross, you know, a little bit above 10 MeV. I don't remember if this plot was from iron. This is the proton ionization distribution, that's not really relevant to this. So, you know, they at some point here, I'm now getting more energy lost from the radiative case than I am from the ionization. And this is a log plot on the y axis. So even by the time I got to about 100 MeV, which is probably right around here, already the radiative losses are, almost 10 times larger than the ionization losses, just going from 10 MeV up to 100 MeV. By the time you get to a GeV, it's much larger. Okay? So again, it depends very much on the detector context. In a neutrino experiment, there'll be a very different situation. Your energies are much, much different. But if you're at a hadron collider, you're dealing with things that are way to the right, past 10 to the 3 in most cases on that plot. So Bremsstrahlung is the important thing. There's another aspect to this that's useful, which is that the when you go to do this relation, now this relation holds for electrons, but ultimately and each ionization curve is a little bit different for different particles, but if you wanted to know, well, we can, I just erased it. Yes. Of course I did. I just erased it. Well, all right. So the radiative losses are proportional to, because of the equation I just erased, 1 over m squared. Okay. So if I want to compare this critical energy to what I would have with a heavier particle, because the electron is very, very light. We can see at a very low energy it's dominated by Bremsstrahlung losses. But what happens if I took the next lightest particle I'm likely to see, which would be a muon? So there, what you have would be that the critical energy for the muon would be the critical energy for the electron times the ratio of their masses squared. Okay? So, actually, my calculation was off a little bit. This must be the atomic number. Yeah, I think this is the atomic number. In fact, for iron, the critical energy equals 20.7 MeV. Okay? And, well, this ratio here, M mu over Me, is approximately 200. So that means that this equals 40,000 times the critical energy for the electron. So if this is the critical energy for the electron, then this is approximately 800 GeV. So you have to have almost a 1 TeV muon to produce most of its energy losses by bremsstrahlung if it was passing through iron. Okay? So that's a very, very high energy. And so for most experiments, that's not really what's happening. But for the electron, it happens very quickly. Did you have a question? No. I thought I saw your hand go. It happens very quickly. Okay? And let's see here. So this is a table of critical energies for various materials. So for lead, you have, now this says iron is 27. They can't make up their mind. Okay, but for lead, you get about 10 MeV, iron about 20-something, copper 25, air in terms of MeV is 100. You have, this is a scintillator we'll talk about in a minute, is about 17 MeV. But these are all pretty low. These are all very low. And so what that means is that in many cases, when you're building a detector where you want to absorb the energy of particles, you have it's a little bit of foreshadowing, but I'll give it. This is a great way to distinguish between particles of a different mass. Okay, for this very reason. So, if I build a detector, and the particles that are coming into that detector are 1 or 10 GeV or something like that, then I know their energy. If I see them bremming, if I see them causing bremsstrahlung, I know they have to be electrons, because it's the only particle that produces a lot of brem at an energy below a few GeV. If I don't see any bremsstrahlung, if I don't see any photon production in that case, then I know I'm dealing with something heavier, like a muon. So now, if I care to, I've just done some particle identification. So I've got two particles in my tracker. All I know is they're both 1 GeV tracks. I don't see anything beyond that, but in the detector that comes afterwards, all of a sudden I see brem in one case and not in another. And that's a principle basically by which an electromagnetic calorimeter is built, because an electromagnetic calorimeter is you put a slab of material in the way of a particle and you force it, if it's an electron, to start bremming. And then you measure the result of that, but you don't put so much material that other particles will create a lot of other kinds of radiation that we'll talk about later. Okay? That's what an electromagnetic calorimeter is trying to do. And so now you see, okay, this looks like I have an electron. Okay? And we'll see that a photon is just one step away from that, because the first thing a photon does is to produce electrons and positrons. And it does it in approximately a radiation length. Okay, and then there's another table really just summarizing a bunch of, so I had my Z wrong. So this is really, actually this is sort of summarizing everything that I've shown you, but for different materials, it's good to have tables. It's not like you have to memorize them, but it's good to have access to these because these are the standard things that people build detectors out of, lead, tungsten, iron, copper sometimes, whatever, okay? Okay, so that's, all right. So that's it for Bremsstrahlung. The next thing I was going to talk about was scintillation, but I don't know if you have any more questions about Bremsstrahlung. I mean, it's the acceleration of the electron in that field, the electric field.
So if it's a neutral electron.
Sorry? If it's a neutral.
Neutral electron, so there is no Bremsstrahlung.
Well, no, the incident particle is neutral, like. If it was a photon, yeah. Okay. What did you say? Or a neutron or something like that. That's not going to Bremsstrahlung. Okay. What happens is, and we'll talk about this more next week, but what actually happens is that, for instance, in a photon case, the first thing it does is it produces an electron-positron pair. Okay, so let me just draw it. I don't think it's bad for me to sort of jump ahead for a minute because then you kind of see where it's going. So here's an atom, here's a nucleus. If I have an electron, okay, then it can produce a photon. Okay. If I have the same atom and I have a photon, okay, well, this photon can produce, I'm not drawing a accurate Feynman diagram here, so I don't want to get in trouble with our theorists, but the photon can now, because it's near, it's interacting with this nucleus, it can produce a electron-positron pair, electron-positron pair, okay? And now this, when it goes, this electron, when it goes by an atom, it can brem. Okay? So a photon will do this quickly, about as quickly as an electron will do this, and then it will do this. That photon will pair produce. This electron will continue to Bremsstrahlung, and we call this an electromagnetic cascade. So we'll talk about this next week, this pair production piece, and then we'll talk about what an electromagnetic shower is when we talk about calorimeters. But this is a very important aspect, and it just so happens that numerically this takes about as much material as this does to within 20%. Okay? Does that answer the question? Okay. These atoms are all neutral. Right, the medium, these are all neutral atoms. You're really looking at the structure of them. So you're really sensitive to here's the nucleus, here's the electrons, and so they don't look neutral to you. You're looking at some complicated electrical field. Okay. Good. That's a good question. Any other questions? No. Okay. all right. Now, the next piece of all of this is I've taken some time for. Let me just recap real quick. I've talked about ionization. Elastic scattering. and Bremsstrahlung. Okay? And I've taken some effort to derive the relations and things like that. And these are very important to energy loss. And when we get to photons interacting with matter, we'll see other processes that will go. But there are a few other, before we leave the topic, these are all what happens with charged particles interacting with matter. Okay? But there are four other processes that I want to talk about without going into quite as much detail. So one I'll talk about today is scintillation. And I'll just list them first, and then we'll go through them today and on Tuesday. There's what's called Cherenkov. Radiation, or the Cherenkov effect. Okay. There's something called transition radiation. And then there's phonon production. And I should warn you that these four topics are unfortunately not dealt with in one convenient place in the textbook, so we jump around a little bit, and so I'll mention where that is. But these three involve the production of electromagnetic radiation of some kind, so visible light, mostly in these cases. This can be significantly shorter wavelength, very shorter wavelength. And this is a vibrational deposition in the material. So, and these are used in a variety of different detectors. This really tends to be used in dark matter at least one dark matter experiment or a couple. Scintillation is used very, very widely for all kinds of things. Trackers, calorimeters, or particle identification detectors. Triggers, it's used very widely. These two, Cherenkov radiation and transition radiation, are usually relied on mostly for particle identification. And it's because they're sensitive to, in one way or another, the speed of a particle, whether it's its gamma or its beta. Okay, but it's, so these, you know, obviously, again, a particle, two particles traveling, they have the same energy, they're going to have a different velocity. So you can discriminate them by looking at Cherenkov or transition radiation. But scintillation is sort of very, very widely used. Okay? Okay, so there's really, the first one that I want to talk about is scintillation. Now, in scintillation, in general, what you have is a particle that's passing through matter, and it interacts with the particles in the matter, and depending on the nature of those particles, and we'll have two basic categories, it can produce the emission of electromagnetic waves, radiation. It doesn't have to be a lot of energy loss, but it can be enough light that we could detect it and do something with it. Okay? So, now there's two general categories of this kind of light production. There's fluorescence, which happens very quickly and phosphorescence, which takes a really long time. And what's usually referred to by scintillation is the type of light production that's very quick, very prompt, happens in a few nanoseconds. Okay, so it's like fluorescence. Okay? And in particular, there are two types of scintillator. There's inorganic scintillator. Now, I'm not going to talk about the detector technology so much as just the process, because in the inorganic case, the process that's happening is different than in the, the organic case. That's the second category. So in the, okay, I guess I'm going to have to draw this. So let's just take a block of material. So let's say that this is sodium iodide. And in it, there are some regions where we have added thallium. So sort of impurity, they can be called impurity centers. Now, the reason that this is done, so let's imagine that those are in different places. The reason that this is done is because when the particle passes through the material, it's going to cause ionization, okay? And without doing much with it, this is just a big block of material, the ionization is just going to recombine, and you're not going to see anything. It's not that very interesting. But imagine we have a particle that passes through. Chemically, what happens is that as we pass through, we'll produce positive nuclei and negative electrons along this particle's path. And what happens is these sort of make their way towards the thallium centers. Okay? So the thallium wants this charge. And what happens is the thallium will end up in some sort of excited state. And it will de-excite and it will emit. So then the thallium sort of put a star for the excited state. And then you'll have a thallium plus some photons with a wavelength that's roughly in the visible wavelength range, actually sort of close to the edge in terms of being very blue. But, okay, so this process can take a few nanoseconds. And so as the particle goes through, what you end up just seeing is a flash of light. Okay? Now, way back, actually 100 years ago, one of the very first ways that people had of actually detecting particles passing was through this effect. The light yields are really, really low, but if you have a very dark room, you can see these particles and you can train your eyes and you can actually see a little a track. You can see a particle go by. And but it's very difficult. So actually, these weren't used until the 1940s as a detector. And they've really become very standard because we could by then build electronic devices that were able to more efficiently identify these photons. So there are pretty few of them. And so they are hard to detect. But if you can detect them, then, this scintillation light is a measure of the ionization that this particle caused, okay? I don't actually, well, we talked about ionization before. What we said is, well, for us to know how much ionization was, we have to count the electrons that were produced. But that's not necessarily true. In this particular case, I can measure the ionization by looking at the scintillation light produced, and they're very correlated. Okay? Okay, so now, yes, sorry. Mm-hmm.
Does passing electron through this block?
Oh, any particle.
Okay, it's a particle.
No.
It's not ionizing thallium, but ionizing sodium.
Well, it would also ionize the thallium. It's just that the amount of thallium is small compared to the total. Most of it is sodium iodide. Okay. Was that the question, or?
Yeah, it is. But what I wonder is, if thallium is also ionized, is it that going to affect those charges themselves?
It's well, yeah. So.
I just don't know about the impact of thallium.
Yeah, well, and I wasn't really prepared to go into. So thallium is, say, in these places. Okay, here's another one. It's all I can say about it really is that it is the type of atom that would like, for instance, electrons, just chemically. Okay. And when electrons are there, then there's, well, yeah, unfortunately, I can't describe the process in more detail than that. But, I mean, you end up with thallium being in an excited state that when it de-excites, emits some photons. Okay. I'll have to remember, but I could try to elucidate that a little better next time. But it's just recombination. You know, the electrons don't leave the material. They recombine in the material, and they produce an excited atom, which then de-excites. Okay? Okay, there's one other aspect of inorganic scintillators. So one of them is sodium iodide. There's several different types. One property of these types of scintillators is whether or not they are hygroscopic. Hygroscopic means, do they absorb ambient water? Okay, so you don't want this. That will really mess up your detector. The detector will age. You don't want this to happen. So. Sodium iodide, well, I don't know how familiar you are with sodium iodide, but in any case, it has that feature. So you actually have to protect it very well so that it does not absorb water. There are other types, and I'll just give you a couple things. For instance, bismuth germanate. Get the chemical, which is widely used. The difference between bismuth germanate and sodium iodide produces more light, but it's hygroscopic. Bismuth germanate is not hygroscopic, but it produces several times less light. But the other strength that bismuth germanate is that its radiation length is smaller. So you need, if you're also building a detector to stop the particle, then you don't want you want that to be as compact as possible. Bismuth germanate will be more compact. Okay. 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 Now there's also as I mentioned, organic scintillators. And actually, these come in a very wide array. There are liquid organic scintillators. There are plastic organic scintillators. And solids. The process here is a little different than what happens in the inorganic case. So in the organic scintillator case, you're dealing with things, so you'll have some organic chemical, but there will be some, you know, the potential energy will be, say, in terms of vibrational modes. And so let's say that this is distance, and this is potential energy. So, you know, this is sort of your classical, not classical, but typical, you would say this if you're trying to model a diatomic molecule, say. And in this region, it's roughly parabolic. But in any case, you have this potential. And so you have some ground state. And you can have excited states where you have energy levels where there is a different potential energy that's being felt. It's a different vibrational state, and you may have an energy level here, and I probably have not drawn this thing properly to scale. Well, maybe. Okay, so when a particle passes through the material, it will interact with the material, and it can leave, you know, deposit some of its kinetic energy, if you will. It can lead to some vibrational energy being deposited in the material. And we're not going to see that. We're going to talk about that later. But so what will happen is we will go, say, let's call our starting point, we were in this energy level, and we end up in energy level B. So we're in a higher energy vibrational state. And So A to B amounts to absorbing energy. Okay. Now we can go, let's call this C. We can lose vibrational energy by going from B to C, and let's call this D over here. We could de-excite going from D back to E. And in this case, you can emit a photon. Okay? Now, this photon's energy is not is not equal to the total amount of energy that was deposited. It's only a fraction of it. So you can see, let's call this E, D to E. So, you know, okay. but some of that energy is deposited. Now, this has two useful aspects. First of all, you get scintillation out, scintillation light out, and that's very valuable. But the other aspect of it is that the wavelengths that you're absorbing at tend not to be the wavelengths that you re-emit at. So, in other words, organic scintillators tend to be more transparent to their own scintillation light. You don't want a scintillator that produces some scintillation light and that light travels and then gets reabsorbed because the material wants to reabsorb it. You want something that's going to let that light get out. And so an organic scintillator generally allows that light out more easily. And it's because of this sort of a diagram where you have, first of all, you end up losing a lot of energy to vibrational states and de-excitations that then propagate, and you don't see that. What you just see is the light that's produced. Okay? Yes? Say it again, that last piece? It goes from A to B. Mm-hmm.
And then it naturally comes to B by itself.
Well, C and D are the same. But yeah, I mean, this here is you're losing vibrational energy. You're in a material, so there's other things nearby. So, you know, you're vibrating and you slam into somebody else and you lose energy to them. So you don't see any of that. That doesn't produce a light that you can see.
Okay.
Right?
Not
really. Well, it's heat. I mean,
no,
that's right. That's right.
So, from D, when it's coming D to E, which is also natural, I mean, it's coming from E.
Mm-hmm. Well, was there a question there? Or?
Yeah.
Yeah. So here, maybe I should try. I can come back to this. I think one of the problems here is that what really this needs is also a good and I'm out of time. Is a good discussion of how energy is lost into vibrational states, which I have to talk about anyways next time. So I'll try to rearrange things a little bit. But basically, yeah, these two transitions. Well, this one and the one you're asking about. Involves the loss of energy to electromagnetic waves. It's a drop in energy level the way you might think of the hydrogen atom. Okay? Whereas this transition from B to C, if in your modern physics class, you wouldn't have talked about so much. You might have talked about it a little bit, but it's a vibrational transition. And what's being lost there is not a photon, it's a phonon. It's a vibration. And if your detector isn't built to sense that energy deposition, and some are, like Jody Cooley's experiment, CDMS, then you just won't see it. It's such a tiny amount of energy that who cares if you heated up the thing a tiny amount? It's irrelevant. But you can see this photon. And a lot of experiments are built to see that in a scintillator. Okay? Does that at least partially answer?
Yeah.
I will try to... I think I have to stop there, but I will try to come back to this and clean it up a little bit. And then we'll go to the next topics. So I will, either today or tomorrow, I will post the remaining pages of lecture notes from week number two's stuff, and you please get your homework in on Wednesday, on Tuesday, and then of course we'll keep continuing on this material on Tuesday. Okay. I saw your.
But I think you only
I saw your emails just very briefly. I don't know. I was feeling very bad this morning, so I didn't get in early enough. But I think one of them was about thesis committees. I had already started to do that, but I hadn't actually done anything, you know, like conclusive yet. So I will. No, I know I got
to. I just wanted to, because I'd sort of forgotten about that.
No. I have to do it, and I have to do it. I know I do. So.
What was the other thing I can't remember?
I only actually glanced at the one.
Okay.
So I don't, whatever the
you could find out.
The first,
you know,
yeah.
What was I said to you.
Yeah, so.
Tell me what the answer is.
So, okay. Well, a lot of them are in the visible wavelengths, and I will talk more about this a little bit more. The issue is that the photodetector you have, a lot of times is a phototube, a photomultiplier tube, and it's more sensitive in the red, and so you need to get the wavelengths from visible red. So you need to get the light from 400 nanometers down to 600 or 500 at least, or something like that. So you need to shift it, and these things tend to fall fast. So shifting it, even if the mean isn't in the middle of the photomultiplier, the area that overlaps the sensitivity of the phototube goes way up. So then there's wave shifters. There are scintillators that produce UV. But, you know, so there's a whole game of, you know, scintillation and then wave shifting, and you try to match things.
You always end up trying to get it typically into the visible.
Well, I think it mostly just is. It does tend to be in the visible, just at least in the ballpark because of the fact that it's atomic transitions. But